Hey everyone, welcome to the Danny Chats podcast, or the Transplant Strong podcast as it's becoming known. Today, this is episode 43, and today I'm joined by Robin, who is from the UK, and she is a liver transplant patient, and she had her transplant 2 years ago. So we're going to find out a bit about her story. Hi Robin, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very, very good. So you contacted me through Facebook, and we're both part of the same Facebook group. And you told me a bit about your story, but do you want to sort of just tell us some more?
Yeah, so my story is simultaneously short, but also quite long, which is always a great way to start. So I didn't know that I had any kind of liver disease or any problems with my liver. About a year before I found out, so this was in 2020 during lockdown, I was experiencing some swelling of my ankles, but I also lived in an attic flat and it was the heat. Like, summer was a big thing, so my initial reaction was that it was just the heat that was causing this. And anyway, you couldn't really go and see a GP around that time because we were all in lockdown.
Yeah.
So I kind of just elevated my legs and it went away. So I just thought that was fine. And then, yeah, around a year later, so April 2021, that was when I was diagnosed with autoimmune hepatitis.
Yeah.
So the March prior to that, I went to my GP because I was feeling quite tired. And I have a history of having an endocrine disorder. So I also have growth hormone deficiency. Okay. And I'd been treated for this as a child, which basically meant injecting myself for 10 years just to grow. So that's great fun. So I just went to the GP because I thought the symptoms I was having was related to the lack of growth hormone. So I had a blood test done. And this was around, I think, the 10th of March 21, and I had a call the next morning around 4 a.m. saying that I needed to go immediately to A&E because my platelet levels were 23, which is very low.
Yeah, no wonder it's so early in the morning.
Yeah, they were like, if you're bleeding, just go straight away, but even if you're not, just go straight away.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, what the hell, that has something to do with me being tired, they must have the wrong blood. That was my first initial thought.
Yeah.
So I took a bus to hospital at 4 a.m. And they did another blood test just to confirm that my platelets were low, and it came back with my liver enzymes being elevated and them not really knowing why. So I ended up being admitted in Croydon Hospital for 2 weeks while they did various different tests to try and figure out what it was.
Yeah.
And that those 2 weeks ended with a biopsy. And then I was sent home while they did the biopsy results. So that then leads us up to April, when I was diagnosed with autoimmune hepatitis. And I had had no symptoms of this at all.
Was you presuming it was something to do with your past problems, or did you think this was something new? Or
I just thought that the swelling legs didn't even register with me at all. I'd actually forgotten that had happened. I had just been feeling tired, and I know that's a symptom of low growth hormone. So that was the only thing I had.
Yeah.
No other symptoms at all. So then to be told at the time of the biopsy that my liver was in a state of cirrhosis, and that I needed to start immunosuppressants straight away and prednisolone and all the fun things, was quite shocking to me.
Yeah.
But I was feeling perfectly fine, which also didn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
So I was started on those medications I just mentioned, and within 5 days, I had my first hepatic encephalopathy episode.
What's that? Can you explain what that is, please?
Yes. So when the liver gets to a state of complete cirrhosis, it means that it's not functioning properly.
Yeah.
And ammonia is one of the waste products of digestion. It's something that most bacteria release when it's decomposing things or digesting things.
Yeah.
The liver is normally able to, I'm not sure the technical scientific words, but I use the word convert. I hope that's okay.
Yeah.
So liver converts ammonia into a urea, which then travels to your kidneys, and your kidneys filter that into urine, and then urine. The reason that happens is because ammonia is a toxic substance. So if the liver is unable to remove the ammonia from your blood, then it builds up and builds up, travels around your body, and then eventually travels to your brain. Causes temporary brain damage, essentially.
That's very, very similar to the disease that I had, which was Wilson's disease. And again, like you say, the liver is supposed to deal with all the copper in the body. But for someone with Wilson's disease, you get that same problem. The liver doesn't filter it, doesn't diet, you know, doesn't get it through the body. So then you get a build up in the blood, and that again goes to the brain and attacks the liver. It's very interesting.
Yeah, so it causes things like confusion. It can make your thinking quite altered. And there's different stages. So you can start with just like feeling a little bit like you're not yourself, then going to stages where you're completely amnesic of what you're doing in those episodes, but you're basically unable to, you're getting words mixed up. You're saying one thing and meaning another thing.
Yeah.
It changes your day-night cycle. So you want to sleep during the day and you're wide awake at night.
That's really
and then if it keeps going. Yeah. So the first episode I had wasn't, I still remember it.
Yeah.
It was quite wild, but I remember, so my ex, who I lived with at the time, she woke me up because the rugby was on, and I'm a huge rugby supporter.
Yeah.
I think it was the Six Nations, if it was April, I would imagine. And I was watching the game, and I kept asking her what different things were. And normally it's the other way around. I'm teaching her.
Yeah.
And it was like, something's wrong. Like, you normally know all this. And so she took me straight to A&E. And the doctor I saw that time, he didn't really know much about liver disease. He didn't know what hepatic encephalopathy was. And he told my ex that what I was experiencing was anxiety, because I'd obviously just been diagnosed with this life-changing liver disease about a few days earlier. And she was convinced that wasn't the case, because when I'm anxious, I don't forget things.
Especially not something that, you know, is so familiar to you.
Yeah. And by the end of that time I was there, I was starting to feel a bit more like myself. So we just went home. But then I think it was maybe a week later. Yes, a week later, I was meant to have an appointment with my hepatologist in Croydon, who I only ever had that one appointment with. And I was in the clinic, and I remember lying in the clinic on a sofa, just trying not to throw up. I just felt so ill. And we did some, well, she did some blood tests and then sent me home, and then called me later that day saying, your potassium is 2.4. which is dangerously low. That's the point where you start having heart issues. They basically sent me straight back in again. And that turns out to be another chronic illness that I have, so that actually isn't related to the liver at all, but the liver was exacerbating it. So basically throughout that time, we're talking kind of end of April, beginning of May, I ended up having three quite severe episodes of hepatic encephalopathy. That's hard to say, hepatic encephalopathy.
I was gonna say to you at some point that how you can even say it is really good anyway, because I'm not even gonna try.
Yeah, it took me a while to learn how to say it quite well. I would have these episodes where I'd be at home, and like for one of them, I remember going to bed on Saturday night and then kind of coming to and it being Tuesday morning.
Really?
And I was in hospital, and I have no recollection of how I got there at all.
It's quite dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's horrifying.
Yeah.
And my ex was showing me videos that she had recorded, because she was showing these to the doctors, because she was trying to figure out what it was. So I think I kept saying, like, I want to laugh, when I meant I needed to use the toilet. I would sit up kind of smoothing the duvet out. and she'd ask me what I was doing, and I was saying, well, if I smooth it, I'll stop being sleepy. You know, like logic that doesn't quite make sense. I'd be unable to dress myself. Apparently, she told me, look, I've called an ambulance, and I tried to immediately start putting on some shoes. And she was like, no, not now. We have to assess you first. Mm-hmm. But every time she kept saying, the paramedics are here, the paramedics are here, I keep trying to put my shoes on. So really not who I am at all.
I had
three episodes like this throughout April, May. And each time I would have one, go to Croydon, be transferred to King's, stay in King's, then be discharged, and then 2 days later, back in Croydon with another episode.
Yeah.
It was like a cycle of just being discharged. And then the last time, my ex just said, look, get an ambulance straight to King's. I'm sick of having to go between Croydon and King's. Just a waste of time. And so the third time I went in was the end of May. And it was at that point that my kidneys started failing. And the reason for this was that my consultant had decided to put me on tacrolimus prior to my transplant. And obviously my liver was not capable of metabolizing anything, let alone tacrolimus. As we all know, if we had a transplant, tacrolimus can damage your kidneys pretty badly. So my kidney function then dropped to about 5% because of tacrolimus. And so, yeah, that was when I then was put on the transplant assessment list. It was an odd kind of assessment because I was an inpatient. So I hear lots of stories about transplant patients coming in and doing the different tests and stuff over the course of 3 days.
Yeah, and then going home and waiting for the call.
Yeah, whereas for me, I never had any of that. So I was an inpatient. A lot of the tests had already been done because I was in and out so frequently. I remember being taken to the bike test and not being able to do it because I'm only 4'11" and the bike was too big for me. My feet wouldn't reach the bottom of the circulation of the pedal. That was a no-go. So I was put on the transplant waiting list after that really scary seminar they do at King's. And then was matched with a liver 5 days later.
Wow, that's quick.
So my transplant was then in the first week of June.
Real rough time leading up to all of that as well.
It didn't end there.
And then when they said to you about having the transplant, how did you feel?
Quite honestly, at that point, I just wanted to be better. I've also been told that, I mean, I was so incredibly ill. I was having these episodes of hepatic encephalopathy. I'm just going to call it HE. I was having these episodes so frequently and I was becoming more and more unwell. I was completely fluid retained. I couldn't walk by myself. I was told that I didn't really have that much longer to live. And I think when you get to that point, you either just want to not be here anymore or you just want to feel better. And because I'd done some research, I knew the average waiting times for livers especially, and I didn't know if I was going to get one in time. So I think because it happened quickly, but also was very, very step by step as well, from like finding out I had autoimmune hepatitis and then being told we're going to transfer you to King's because we think is quite a high level of cirrhosis, to then having the HE episodes and then being so terrified of those, and then having assessments kind of at King's and being told it's worse than we think it is, and then just constantly having these episodes of not knowing where I am or who I am. By the time transplant was mentioned, I wasn't scared of it at all.
I can imagine. Did you see any pictures of your liver afterwards?
No, but I know that some people have.
I got them to take pictures and I've got them at home somewhere.
I think they have some of mine, but I haven't asked, but I kind of want to.
Yeah, I don't know why, but it's just weirdly interesting to see.
Yeah.
So then you sort of said that it was still quite rough after your transplant.
Yeah, so my transplant was a skin only closure. Because again, like I mentioned, I'm only 4'11".
Yeah, so can you explain what that means then, please?
Yeah, of course. So because I am so petite, and apparently my abdominal cavity is quite small, even in proportion to me, even though they try and size match organs as best as they can, because when you have cirrhosis, your liver normally shrinks anyway.
Yeah.
And then my spleen was incredibly large, which is also another side effect of cirrhosis. Yeah. There wasn't enough space for my new liver in the space. And so if they had closed the muscle and then the skin, there would have been too much pressure pushing down on the liver, which then might have reduced blood flow. So what they do instead is they leave the muscle open and then just stitch the skin together. So it's essentially like a massive hernia.
Yeah.
Entire length of my scar. And because I'm quite small, my scar is quite big.
Yeah.
So the vertical incision was fully closed, but the horizontal one was fully open. So I, rather than having the sort of dissolvable stitches that most people have, I had these really thick black nylon stitches right across, which were very uncomfortable. And they used to, like, if you pin them on clothing, it would send like horrible feelings everywhere. they were horrendous. But I wasn't made aware that this had happened until 5 weeks after my transplant.
So you just thought that the way it had been done was the same as everyone else's?
Yeah, though I had my suspicions that normally you wouldn't have those kind of stitches. But when I would mention it to the coordinators who would come in, I would be like, is this normal? And they would tell me yes. And I wasn't going to not trust them, even though I felt like it wasn't.
Yeah.
And I kept being told, as you would know, you know, come on, mobilize. And it feeling very uncomfortable. I mean, obviously I had no abdominal muscles, but well, come on, get up, get walking, and me being like, oh, this feels really weird, but not knowing any different.
So
5 weeks later, I was finally, like, my consultant wasn't even aware of this. And we found out 5 weeks later that this had happened. And so then I was actually given an abdominal binder to wear, which helped immensely. I did not take that thing off.
The surgeon hadn't told the consultant?
Correct.
Wow.
So I kept having misleading information for quite a while when they thought it was closed. It wasn't closed. No, this bit was closed and that bit wasn't. Oh no, the whole thing is open. It was a weird kind of dialogue over some different clinics.
Yeah. There seems to be that in hospitals now. Like, I don't remember the days of matrons and things like that, but although speaking to the older nurse groups, like, they all wish it would go back to like the way it was. I think they say it's so so many different compartments everywhere that things get mislaid, misread, and it kind of, there's no flow to it, so then these mistakes happen.
Yeah, and I think also when things aren't put down in the electronic systems as it should be, then there's no paper trail to follow anyway, because if it's not in the system, they're looking for it. So it was never put down in my system, and people don't talk, they just rely on what's written. And if it's not written, then they're not going to know about it. So that obviously meant that at some point I would have to have another surgery to close my muscle wall. But normally, because the liver is such a clever organ, once it gets used to the type of blood flow it's receiving, it will kind of shrink or adapt to the space. So the whole point is you wait a bit of time for it to kind of settle in.
Yeah.
If you were, and then to reclose the muscle wall. So I went in for my muscle closure surgery, August bank holiday, and that surgery failed because I ended up having an anaphylactic reaction to tazazine on the operating table. And tazazine is something that I'd had many, many times prior to my transplant and during my transplant. It's quite a common antibiotic. So that kind of came out of nowhere. So I remember waking up thinking, yes, I'm finally free, I can walk without this binder, and then slowly realizing actually nothing has changed.
Yeah.
And I was completely swollen up like a balloon and couldn't breathe very well. So I wasn't expecting to wake up in ICU after that. It's just like a hernia repair. But to wake up in ICU being intubated was quite scary. I mean, after transplant, you're expecting it, but when you're not expecting it, it's kind of worse.
Yeah, from what you think is a simple routine procedure of just, you know, like you say, oh, I'm just going in and get my muscles stitched up, which to some people sounds mad, but when you've had a liver transplant, it's like, yeah, this is all right, just go in and get that done.
Like, yeah, exactly. So that happened in August, and then I went in for the second go in November, and my surgery was due the day before my birthday.
Oh.
And I had the surgery, and the surgery went fine. I came out of surgery, I don't have any memory of it, I think I was still a little bit high or whatever. And then later that evening and into the night, my heart rate started going extremely fast. I was in the step down unit right at the end of Todd Ward, if you know it. I was rushed into the ICU, and they tried to cardiovert me with drugs. So cardioversion is when they do this kind of stand clear shock thing.
Yeah.
They do it with chemical drugs before they go to the machine. So they tried to use the drugs, which failed. And I actually knew they would fail because it's called adenosine, and it works for 99.9% of patients, but it didn't work for my mum who has a heart condition. So I somehow suspected it wouldn't work for me, and it didn't. And I remember saying to them, like, oh, kind of that drowsy going, it won't work, and it didn't work. So then they did the stand clear shock, and that then made my heart more normal, but then I kind of stopped breathing, and so they rushed to intubate me, and then something happened called aspiration pneumonia, which is where I basically, it sounds graphic, I'm sorry, but I basically threw up the tube and then swallowed my lungs. Hence ended up with pneumonia and sepsis. So they had to re-extubate me and then intubate me again because the tube was there. And then ended up being intubated for a week in ICU as a result of that. So that was even more shocking.
The wards.
Yeah, so you know, I thought waking up in ICU after anaphylaxis was horrifying. Waking up and it being a week and having missed my birthday, that was even more horrifying for me.
I just couldn't imagine it.
Yeah.
Like, you must, I mean, how are you now? Have you got to a point where things have leveled out?
Yeah, so it took a long time to figure out what the heart problem was. And it turns out, I mean, I actually have 6 chronic conditions, which were diagnosed at the time of my transplant. So yeah. I've been living life with these issues without even knowing it. I didn't have the heart condition, but we eventually found out that I have something called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, which is quite rare, and I won't get into it. But basically, even though my heart is normal now, they don't really understand it well enough to understand why I still have symptoms. Because if you look at my heart, it looks normal, but I still have episodes of tachycardia. So that was the last thing out of all of my conditions that wasn't stable. And I started heart medication about a month ago, which has completely settled it now. So my heart rate was constantly too high, and now it's mostly normal.
Yeah.
And that was the last symptom to kind of smooth down and make it stable. And yeah, now I'm fine.
And the liver?
Liver's been great since day one.
Has it? And how's the scar and everything healed up now?
Yeah, so it's actually really interesting because I find this interesting, but my scar was very different from most people's scar because it looked like upside down exclamation marks. So a line and then like line dot, line dot, line dot because of where the stitches were. And when they went in and reclosed it, they basically removed that entire area of scar tissue and then stitched up the two gaps, like a tummy tuck, I guess.
Yeah.
Now I have a nice neat scar, which has healed really well, as opposed to my really ugly exclamation marks. And much
Wow. It's so good that the liver transplants worked for you and you know, that's all stable, but you must be on a lot of medication.
Yes, a lot. I think I'm on 14 different medications.
Yeah.
That's just a combination of my other chronic conditions and then all the ones for the liver and then all the ones you have to take because of the ones for the liver.
Pills on pills on pills.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm pretty used to it now.
Yeah. You're clearly a very happy, smiley person. So, you know, everything that you've been through, I don't want to say it hasn't affected you because that would be a complete lie, but how have you managed to, you know, keep that cheerful look on your face and deal with everything that's gone on?
I think, so there's kind of two reasons. The first reason is that I have been studying towards becoming a psychotherapist. Yeah. And I was in the middle of my master's when all of this happened.
Yeah.
And weirdly enough, my entire fascination for the last 10 years academically and my aim with therapy has always been trauma therapy, and I've always been fascinated by dissociation. I've actually been writing my dissertation for the last week, and it's all about dissociation, and that's kind of been my topic. I've been planning this for years. So dissociation is something that I know so much about, and so I didn't really need life to give me an experience of actually knowing what it feels like, but it did. And so in a way, it's kind of given me a new kind of shift in what I want to do. Like, I wanted to work with patients who had experienced dissociation and trauma, but now I want to shift that towards medical trauma specifically, and even transplant if I can. I'm doing a lot of stuff with Paul at King's to try and implement some kind of therapeutic service within King's, because I feel like there needs to be one. And so as much as what's happened to me has been really hard for me to deal with, it's also given me a renewed passion for what I want to do with my life. That being helping other patients who have gone through this, dealing with their mental health and stuff like that. So that's one reason. And then the second reason is that I've been very lucky enough to have correspondence with my donor's family. So actually, these two cards behind me that you can see are from my donor's family. And so being able to hear from them how much my presence gives them comfort also kind of makes me incredibly grateful, for one, but also kind of gives me that desire to do the best I can with my life and the chance that I've been given because of them, because I feel like that's the best way in which all of us can honor our donors, you know, is to take what we've been given and not let it get to the point where you can't get out of bed because you're so kind of caught up in the trauma of it all, but being able to use that to go forward and do something good.
I think you make a really positive impact on people's lives, especially, you know, it'd be great to have something like that at King's.
Yeah, that's my absolute dream. It's for there to be some kind of therapist who goes around on the wards, because I know there is, but only if you're under 26.
Oh, really? Yeah, because I don't remember. I had like personal counselling, like through the government, I think it was some way. But that was after I come out, and I had to wait a long time for that. And then even then, talking to the guy about the whole situation, he was just like quite blown away about it, because he'd never had a transplant. He'd never met anyone that had a transplant, so he didn't really know what to say. So I think, you know, none of us want to have that experience, but if you have had that experience and you can go on to help other people, then that's really nice.
Yeah, I think also because when you're training to be a therapist, you have to be in therapy. It's one of the rules. So I already had a personal therapist that I was paying for at the time that all of this happened. As I explained, it happened completely out of nowhere. And so even when I was in King's, I was still having weekly therapy. So one of the nurses would taken me to the visitor's space in Howard Ward. I'd quite frequently be in there in my little chair having therapy.
Nice just to get off the ward sometimes though, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And even when I was unable to get my laptop, I would still have telephone appointments with her. So I experienced firsthand how beneficial having therapy was throughout that process.
Yeah.
It just makes me even more sad that it doesn't exist right now.
Yeah.
Also, I don't think my therapist would ever want to work with another transplant patient going through it. It was quite horrific for both of us, I feel.
Well, you've definitely had a lot of ups and downs, more so downs at one point than ups, but you've pulled through it all.
Yeah, it feels like that. I mean, 2021 was just a pretty awful year.
Yeah.
But yeah, I try and do the best I can with it. Yeah, I hope to make a difference to people. I also do talks in schools now as well. So I talk to medical students.
Okay.
So I try and explain to them the process of being a patient throughout the transplant process, but I also talk about mental health in it as well. I think there's a tendency for doctors to forget the mental health aspect of it all.
Yeah.
So I try and do what I can to raise awareness as best I can.
That's really good, because I know it's easy for us to judge doctors and nurses, but there's so much to learn, especially as a doctor. And if you're not a specialist in something, then you know, there's such a wide range of things to learn. So like, it's very easy to judge them when they make a missed call or stuff. But I think you can judge, but without actually doing anything to try and help, like you're doing, like these talks and stuff, then, you know, it's important that if you think there's a problem, that you get out there and actively try and help it like you're doing.
Sorry, I lost you for a second.
So I was just saying, basically, you know, like, it's easy for us to judge doctors that don't understand all these problems because they're not a specialist in certain things, but without actually getting out there and reaching out to doctors and nurses and, you know, explaining certain situations, it's hard for them to even to understand.
Yeah, and I think also they are very keen to learn.
Yeah.
The training just isn't there. I mean, funnily enough, the most alert I've ever been in ICU was directly after my transplant.
Yeah.
And I remember my one-to-one nurse saying to me, "So what do you do when you're not here?" And me saying, "Oh, I'm training to be a therapist." And her saying, "Oh, great. So how would you deal with people who are in ICU?" And I ended up having a whole discussion with my nurse about therapy.
Yeah.
Which she found incredibly fascinating, because she said to me, like, we quite often want to try and talk to our patients about how they're feeling mentally.
Yeah.
But quite often they don't want to talk to people about it, because in that moment they kind of feel like, well, why would you ever understand how I'm feeling right now?
Yeah.
That's why I feel like, for me, having been through it, I have more of an understanding that I want to help people who have been through it and have them know that I've been through it as well.
Yeah, because hospitals can miss that, also that sort of emotional side of it all, because doctors are very facts and figures, and that's
yeah.
It. So,
like, you know, the little booklets that you get at every stage of transplant that explain to you what tubes will come out of where and where the drains will be. There's not a single page in that book about how you might be feeling.
Yeah.
I want to add one in there at some point in my career. That's one of my aims.
I like it. It's been really, really interesting talking to you, and your story is definitely, you know, it's, like I said, full of ups and downs, and I'm sure very inspirational to anyone else watching this to see, you know, how well you've pulled through it all, and the sort of changes you're making going forward. It's really good to see.
Thank you.
I'll let you get on with the rest of your day. So thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.